Whenever you are, we're ready.
You're ready. Okay. I'd like to convene the joint session of the Ways and Means Committee and the Finance Committee. And what we're doing this evening is having an overview of the February forecast. Most of us have read about it and heard about it, but this will be a formal presentation and an opportunity to begin to ask some general questions and get a feeling for some of the things that you may not have picked up on in the media or earlier briefing. So, Commissioner Hansen, I'm not sure which of the three of you is starting. I think it's probably you.
I think it's me, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
And I,
Commissioner Hansen.
Thank you for having me. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I feel like I should have my own nameplate now. I've been before you now more times already this session than most sessions. What we're going to do, Mr. Chairman, members, I'll start with some overview comments, and then the forecast is really two main stories, two, you know, kind of big pieces that the gentleman to my right will each take a piece of it. The federal stimulus impact on the forecast will be discussed by our state budget director, Jim Showalter, and the impact on the economy will be addressed by Dr. Tom Stinson, our state economist. But I would like to have you first focus on the first slide of our presentation. You will see that the operative number, the 10 and 11 deficit, is $4.57 billion. I think it's important to note that had we not had the federal stimulus, you see the stimulus number there, 1.8. If we had not had the stimulus, our deficit would have been almost $6.4 billion. And I should also note that if you think back, excuse me, if you think back to May 30th, 2007, that's when we were predicting a $1.1 billion balance in the 10 and 11 biennium, Mr. Chairman. This is now, with this 6.4, that is almost a $7.5 billion turnaround in our state in about 21 months. That's fairly significant and the main story in this forecast as we talk about it. The next page just gives you a little more detail on the numbers. You will see that from the November forecast to the February forecast, we lose $1.16 billion in revenue, and we have a minor uptick in spending at $152 million. On the federal stimulus, that portion of the stimulus that we receive in 2010. 2011 is $1.3 billion, and the balance we carry forward, $236 million for the 4.57 total. And just, again, some more numbers. It shows you the more complete 8-9 picture in 10 and 11. The main help we receive in the forecast is the surplus in 2008-09 of $236 million, Mr. Chairman. That is entirely due to the $464 million we receive in the federal stimulus. That is very helpful. You will see without that, we would have had a deficit, and we would have been having to talk with you today about how we were going to
fix that. Representative Huntley had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner Hansen. The 1359 stimulus comes with strings on it that we have to put up 40% of that money to get that. So, is the governor intending then to not make the cuts to medical assistance that he had previously suggested?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, for purposes of the forecast, we assume the receipt of the money from the federal government. The governor's budget is a kind of a separate conversation. We have the reason that the stimulus money is the only money that we recognize in the forecast. It's the only piece of the stimulus that the legislature has given prior statutory authority to receive. Receive the money. So we assume the receipt of the whole the federal stimulus. The governor's budget comes later as we react to this.
Well, and Mr. Chair, just remember that that $1.3 billion is up in the air at this time, and we may never see it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, as we introduce the governor's changes to the budget we gave you in January, we will have to abide by the maintenance of effort requirements that are in the federal bill. I think we're generally thinking in the neighborhood of $200 million, and we will abide by those maintenance of effort requirements going forward.
Co-Chair Coleman?
A follow-up to that, then, Commissioner Hansen or Mr. Showalter. So if that $200 million is a prerequisite to be able to get the stimulus money, would it be safe to say then that we should put another negative $200 million on the bottom line? Or are you counting that as part of your reserve funds for 2009?
Mr. Chairman, the stimulus, as we receive it, is based on current law. The governor's budget is not law yet. I mean, it's just simply a proposal to the legislature. So we currently abide, under current law, we meet the maintenance of effort requirements.
Okay, very good.
I think that's the
thank you.
Best way to...
I just want to mention we are being recorded. And so with the cell phones and so on going on, if you could turn those off, just a reminder, you may notice the cameras are on. So we're not being broadcast, but we're being recorded. Commissioner Hansen, if you want to continue.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. The again, just to highlight the conversations that we just had, the only money that we recognize, the only stimulus money that we recognize in this forecast, as Mr. Showalter will talk about in a minute, is federal medical assistance money. We don't recognize the fiscal stabilization and all the other accounts because we don't have prior statutory authority. We have statutory authority to receive and to recognize and use federal medical assistance money when it's received. The state portion and the other funds that have been made available to us as a state, we will be working with you on to get authorization authority in the months to come. With that, I will turn it over to Mr. Showalter, who will talk about the federal stimulus and its impact.
Just got a note that we are being broadcast. I thought we were simply being recorded, but either way the cell phones should be off. But the announcement still holds.
Mr. Chair, members, if I may continue then the presentation. My name is Jim Showalter. For the record, I'm the State Budget Director. In the next couple of slides, I will discuss some of the stimulus assumptions that are included in this forecast, as well as some things that are not in the forecast. As you all know, the federal government has enacted a broad and sweeping act to try and stimulate the economy. That has money going to individuals, it has money going for tax changes, and it has significant money coming to state and local governments. Roughly $4.6 billion is estimated to be coming to Minnesota as a result of that act. And it comes in a variety of ways. Much of that money is not directly tied to the general fund or the deficits Commissioner Hansen has just been talking about. Much of this money is coming for specific dedicated projects, for specific programs, maybe I should say, not for deficit reduction necessarily. But there are two broad categories that are sort of counter-cyclical in nature, and I'll talk about those in a second. The key thing for you right now is that roughly $1.8 billion was included in this forecast from the stimulus bill that comes from the Federal Medical Assistance Program. To be specific, it's not revenue. We were talking just a minute ago, Representative Huntley was asking questions about how much are we really going to get from this stimulus bill, from this federal Medicaid match. This is our estimate of the value of essentially a price discount on medical assistance and to a smaller extent Minnesota Care from now all the way through to December 2010. Normally we pay 50% of the total cost during this period. Instead, we're going to basically pay 40%. That price discount, of course, yields some savings. That's what we're talking about here. If we buy less health care, it would yield less savings. And that's, I think, the nature of the budget discussions that will go forward in the weeks and months to come. The stimulus package in general has several different components. I talked about the first two, referenced them as counter-cyclical. They're really targeted towards states to help Minnesota and all the other states avoid pulling back on spending just at a time when the economy is the weakest. The Medicaid match, the enhanced Medicaid match, is worth about $1.8 billion based upon our state estimates, based upon the numbers that we've got from DHS that are specifically tied to our populations and our understanding of the effect of the economy on those populations. The other piece that will have to be considered one way or another through this legislative session is the state stabilization funds, worth roughly $800 million. That's broken into two different pieces, one for education, one for general purposes, education piece being the much larger of the two. That funding is also countercyclical, helping make sure the states have funds to maintain education, both K-12 and higher education spending, and also some funds for general purpose to state government activities. There are maintenance of effort requirements that are tied with those. There are ceilings as to how far we can go with those funds as well. It is a fairly complex piece of legislation and trying to understand exactly the impact. But for purposes of the committee's understanding, it's $800 million, and it's certainly germane to the overall budget picture. The other $2 billion is in that next block of what we call dedicated funding here. You've heard a lot about highway funding, bridge funding, clean water, and many, many other programs. Those programs all fall into this other category where those funds are either going to be coming into the federal fund and being spent out of that fund, or perhaps out of dedicated funds like the Trunk Highway Fund or some of the environmental funds. The last group of money we don't have a good estimate right now on how much we might get, but it's the competitive grant. It's certainly a much smaller piece than these other first two pieces, but we have some opportunity to try and get some funds out of a nationwide competition for lots of interesting and potentially beneficial actions such as health information technology, broadband development, things like that.
Can I ask a question, Mr. Showalter? Mm-hmm. That $2 billion then under the dedicated funding, that's where the Pell Grant increases would appear, I assume. And do you have a number yet in terms of what that means in terms of state dollars that we're currently spending for the state grant program? You know, when the Pell Grant goes up, then unless we change the law, then there's funding that's not being spent under the financial aid formula, and if you know what that number is.
Right.
I've heard different numbers. I've heard 60, 69, and even a higher number at one point.
Mr. Chair, members, I will get back to it, a precise number. The number that's in my head is $58 million, but I should check that out. That actually isn't included in the dedicated funding total for reasons that there's some programs that go to individuals like that, like UI, unemployment insurance, some other things that we weren't quite sure how to categorize them, but they certainly are in that other bunch of programs. They're just not actually in this list.
If you can get me that, I'd appreciate
I'd be happy.
Thank you. Oh, Representative Kahn?
Yes, in the competitive, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Showalter, or anyone, in the competitive grant... in the competitive grant part, does that include the appropriation to NFS and NIH? Is that included in that line?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, yes.
So
there's also a lot of housing programs that will be in that competitive grant.
And that's called that because that's competitive across the country?
That's right.
So it's individuals applying And is there kind of like a shovel-ready concept on that or not?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think they would like to move forward with those quickly, but because these are brand new programs, they are literally haven't even offered the instructions or the construction of the programs, much less how quickly they're going to get those programs out. Unlike the $2 billion of existing programs where everyone already knows the language, knows the reporting mechanisms, knows those things, these are made up from the ground up. To continue on then, Mr. Chair, I started this discussion with the impact in the forecast, and that is singularly the medical assistance spending. We just include this graphic to help you understand the impact and the choices really for the state in the next couple of years. The budget will get relief and is recognizing that relief in this forecast. The dark portion of this bar represents the state share of medical assistance spending 2008 through 2013. As you can see, in 2009, 2010, and 2011, that rate of growth is arrested because of the federal money that's coming in. That federal money is represented by the white boxes on top of it and the amounts of money that were estimated under current law to get an enhanced FFP is shown there in the graphic. The problem, of course, is... The problem that Minnesota and all other states will face, of course, is once that enhanced FFP gets taken off, we will be going back to our 50% match rate. And so the cost of health care in the state will, as a portion of our budget, will rise pretty rapidly as we get back to our normal trend line. The stimulus still doesn't slow down the cost of growth of health care overall. It just slows down how much states are paying for a couple of years.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Showalter, what is the gap there between FY11 and 12 in terms of the state cost? I mean, it looks like from the sits on the bodies there were it's not quite $1 billion, but maybe getting close. Do you have that number?
Yeah, I do. Mr. Chair, Representatives, the 2011 figure is the state share would be $3.8 billion. In 2012. When there's no enhanced FFP coming in, that number will be $4.7 billion.
And for 13?
5.1. If there are no more questions on the stimulus package, then I will turn it over to Dr. Vinson to talk about the economy generally. As the Commissioner said initially, there's really two major segments to this forecast. One is the lower cost to health care due to the stimulus bill that's reflected here in this medical assistance graphic, and then, of course, the economy and the impact that has on state revenue.
Mr. Chair. Just to round this all out, Mr. Showalter, it looks like FY10, the state share is about $3 billion. Is that right?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative, but I'll go from left to right.
Okay.
In 2008, $3.2 billion, dropping to $3 billion in 2009, to $3.1, to $3.8 in 2011, then up to $4.7 and $5.1.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Dr. Stinson, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Tom Stinson. I'm a state economist, and I'm also a professor at the University of Minnesota.
If you can get a little bit closer to the mic, that's okay.
That's such a good
trait. Yeah, talking to my business.
Mr. Chair, it's no surprise the economy is weaker than we'd expected in November, and when the economy is weaker, revenues almost always go down, and they do go down in this forecast. For fiscal year 2009, the remainder of this biennium, forecast revenues are down by $213 million. $133 million of that reflects our negative variance in receipts that we've had since November. That's really just carrying forward the weaker receipts that we've seen since November and to the end of the fiscal year. For 2010-2011, the revenues are down 1.166 billion. Of that, 701 million is in the income tax, the individual income tax. A portion of that's due to the weaker economy flowing through to lower wages, but another portion of that is due to a change we made in capital gains realizations assumptions. The November forecast assumed that capital gains would fall by 35% in 30% in 2008 and an additional 10% in 2009. We changed that forecast in February to show a 40% decline in 2009. That creates a loss of more than $200 million of the $700 million loss in the forecast. The graph that's on the screen here also now shows a big jump in 2010. This big jump in 2010 again reflects existing federal law, which has an increase in capital gains tax rates following 2010. We continue to forecast, based on existing law, that there will be an acceleration of capital gains realization in 2010, because logically people will want to make use of the lower federal tax rate. That is again roughly $200 million of acceleration in there. Should that law not change, should the capital gains tax rate remain at 15% in 2010, that $200 million would be taken out of the forecast when that happened. And so to the extent that the capital gains tax rate does not go up in 2010, that costs us $200 million. The changes are all, other than the capital gains change, the changes really are all due to a weaker than expected economy. We are in a recession. Obviously, there's no surprise to that, but a lot of people may not understand what this recession really is. And the simplest way that I have to explain it is that given the low economic growth rate that we have, and given the fact that inflation is very small, over the next year, the total receipts of all businesses everywhere in the country are going to be less than the total receipts were in 2008. Now, that's not the profits. That's the total receipts. That's the money that goes into the cash register, the money that goes across the counter. That's what we're talking about. And this is a very unusual situation. There are a couple of questions that everyone has about the recession. The first one is, how long is it going to last? And the answer is that Global Insight, at this point in the February forecast, thinks that it is going to be over with by late summer, and that we will start to grow in late summer again. There is, however, an increasing number of individuals. There is an increasing body of thought that this may be a little bit optimistic. Chairman Bernanke, in talks last week, was talking about the recession being over if things went well by the end of the year. He wasn't saying by the middle of the summer or anything like that. So that's a concern. This forecast could be a little bit optimistic from Global Insight in terms of the timing of the stop of the recession. The second question is, how bad is it going to be? can, the answer is that it's likely to be the worst recession since World War II. 2.7% decline in real GDP is forecast by Global Insight. They are forecasting that we lose about 6 million jobs over the course of the recession until rehiring starts. We've already lost about 3 million jobs, and so there's another 3 million jobs to be lost again. And the recovery is very slow. It's not until 2012 that national levels of payroll employment return to their pre-recession levels. To this point, the recession has been more severe in Minnesota than it has nationally.
Dr. Stenson, can I just have you go back one slide? My understanding is that the last quarter of 2009 was in GII's forecast was of
2008.
Last quarter of 2008 was a decrease of about, I think, about 1% in that area someplace. And the actual decrease was 2.7 or something like that. Is that correct?
Yes. Now, on this graph, if you adjusted that for that change, if updated for that, what you'd have is you'd have this blue bar coming down about to the point where the bottom of this 2 is. And so so you'd see an even larger decline both on the blue line and the blue bar.
Dr. Smith, my question is, do we have some kind of a rough estimate of what that would be? I know we would start from a lower base as well, but is there any kind of a rough estimate in our model that would give us some kind of estimate of figure of what that might be?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, without knowing what's going to happen to 2009, the forecast for 2009, we can't make a statement on that. We're going to start from a lower base, but if what's happened is that the bad news has been pushed into the fourth quarter of 2008 and then the economy takes off a little faster in the first quarter of 2009 than was previously expected, that would not necessarily be bad for the state's revenues, and in fact it might be good because we've already collected most of the revenue that we're going to collect based on economic activity in the fourth quarter of 2008.
So are you saying in effect then that the negative bar in the next bar would probably be a little bit less? Is that what you're saying?
It could be, but it also could be that it's just things were worse in the last part of 2008 and we're just going to go on from that lower base and grow more slowly. And so until you work through all of the numbers on that, it's just not really possible to...
Okay, thank you. Representative Cole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Stenson, I don't want my friends on my side of the aisle to think I'm going soft, but I was listening to NPR earlier today as I was driving to my other job, and as I got to my employer and had to turn my car off, they were talking to an economist, and they asked this individual, or they were having a discussion about whether when do we stop being in a recession and when do we get into a depression? And I'm just curious as to I mean, none of the news you're giving me is very uplifting. In fact, it's depressing. I'm not sure that it qualifies as an economic depression. Is there a standard that economists use with regard to when we move from a recession to a depression? And if so, what is it? And are we getting close?
Dr. Stenson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cole, there really isn't a formal definition of the difference between a recession and a depression. A recession is defined as an extended period of broadly based economic decline, and a depression is something that is more extended and deeper than that. Typically, recessions have been somewhere in the 8 to 10 month period. Kind of in general, Robert Farrell, Harvard economist, says it's got to go roughly 3 years, and that a 10% total decline might be what you talk about. Now, the Great Depression in the 1930s, of course, went on for more than 3 years, but it had a 25% decline in real GDP and unemployment rates in excess of 25%. And so we're a long ways from that kind of change. You know.
Mr. Chairman, that's the first bit of good news I've heard Dr. Simpson give all day. Stop there, thank you.
But there's also one other definition, and that is if you lose your job, I think it's a recession. When I lose mine, it's a depression.
I was, Mr. Chairman, just going to point out that this morning I looked in Webster's to find out the definition of a depression, and obviously that's not a good economic text, if you will, but you could argue that by that definition we might be there, because they talk about high unemployment, they don't say how much, they also make some other references in Webster's, but at one time I thought, Dr. Simpson, you indicated that a depression was 2 quarters of negative economic growth, or that somebody did that, wasn't you? Okay.
No, that's kind of the newspaper definition of a recession. It's 2 quarters.
The recession is two quarters of negative economic growth.
Okay. Okay, continue on, Dr. Simpson.
As I said, sometimes national economic weakness skips Minnesota by, as I'll show you in just a minute, but this time it is not, and actually the situation in Minnesota has been more serious and is expected to be more serious than nationally in this forecast. We now project job losses in Minnesota to reach 120,000 by the end of the recession. By early 2010, that's when we expect that jobs will begin to turn around, we'll start adding jobs again. To put that in perspective, normally we would expect in Minnesota that you would see about 40,000 jobs per year added to the economy. So what we're doing is we're losing 3 years of job growth here. Actually, if you look at the current data, we now have fewer jobs in Minnesota than we did at the start of the 2001 recession. Since 2001, now we have not gained any employment. In fact, we're down just a little bit. But looking on out into the future, we expect quite a few more jobs to be lost. We've already lost 35,000 jobs, 50,000 jobs through January, we've already lost 50,000 jobs, and then we've lost an additional 20,000 jobs through January. We had 35,000 jobs in the forecast to be lost in the months of January, February, and March, and so we're a little bit ahead of schedule in terms of meeting that target, unfortunately. With
Dr. Simpson, can I just ask
Mr. Hansen a question? As you looked at the larger document that we have, usually we have some of these statistics in the larger document as well. And the only time we've seen this is on the slide. Is that an oversight, or I don't think we've talked in the larger one.
Yeah.
Is there the great big one of job loss?
It's in there.
It's in there. Okay, thank you. Continue on, Dr. Simpson.
The one thing that another bit of good news for Representative Cole is that things would have been even worse without the stimulus package. That we estimate that about 45,000 jobs were either saved or created by the stimulus package in Minnesota. And so for some industries, for example, for the construction industry, we currently forecast that the construction industry will lose another 15,000 jobs without the stimulus package, we would have lost another 22,500. So that is making, the stimulus package is making a difference.
Yeah, I have Representative Coles and Representative McNamara to this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Stinson, I recall seeing something when the stimulus bill was passed that came either from the White House or from Speaker Pelosi's office saying that Minnesota would be either saving or retaining or gaining or retaining 66,000 jobs. Why the difference?
Representative Coles, it's because we're a little more conservative in our estimates than the White House and the Speaker's office. That is, the official estimate is 3.6 million jobs, I think, saved nationally, 66,000 in Minnesota. Most forecasting services think somewhere between 2.2 and 2.5 million jobs will be saved nationally, and that for Minnesota, you're talking somewhere in the 40 to 50,000 job range.
And did the Representative McNamara?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Stinson, haven't we historically in other recessions, Minnesota, have we ever been below the curve? I thought historically Minnesota, in previous ones, we were able to do a little better than nationally. Why would this time would we be doing worse than national average?
Dr. Stinson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, let me show you part of the answer to your question here. It's not in the packet. It's a graph that we've prepared since then. But it's kind of an interesting graph. And this tracks what's happened to employment in Minnesota during a bunch of recessions, not just the last couple of recessions, but several recessions. And what you see here is, like for the 73-75 recession, yes, we did dip down just a little bit, but we didn't ever really dip down very much. And at the end of the 5 years after the start of the 73-75 recession, we were at almost 20% more jobs than we did at the start of the recession. This line here is the 1990-91 recession. That one just pretty well skipped by Minnesota, that it was a bi-coastal recession. It was focused on defense industry, financial industry, skipped by Minnesota. This one here is the 1981-82 recession, and well, I want to show you a different version of that, and that is there were two recessions, which I'm sure Representative Solberg and Representative Carlson both remember well, Representative Kahn probably. And if you look at this green line, that shows the path with the two recessions, how much we lost in the way of jobs. And you see that we actually lost a greater percentage of jobs in the combination of the 1980-81-82 recessions than we are projecting at this one. But the striking thing about this recession, which is kind of this red area here, is that it takes until 2012 to get back to where we were. So it's not quite as deep as the 1980-81 recession. The 1980-81-82 recession was more severe in Minnesota than it was nationally. But even though it's not quite as deep, we don't recover quite as quickly as we would have, as we did in the 1980-81-82 recession.
Mr. Redford.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Stinson, do you see some things that were similar in the 81 and this one? Is there sectors or something that maybe would draw similarities?
Actually, what I'm struck by is the differences as opposed to the similarities. And the differences are in part that the recession of the 1980s was broader than it is in that it the agricultural sector of the U.S. and in Minnesota both was hit much harder than the agricultural sector is being hit now. The effect on the mining and mineral sector in the 80s was represented Carl, represented Fulbright, and he can tell you it was much more devastating than it is now, not to put aside the fact that we are seeing cutbacks in the mining industry, but that was something that was just really devastating to the Iron Range. The difference, one of the differences and one of the reasons why the economy is not likely to recover as quickly once it begins to recover is the differences in demographics. I know a lot of you have heard state demographer Tom Gillespie and me talk about the differences in demographics and what's gone on with the baby boom. But here's a graph that shows what's happened to the key demographic ages in there. We look in the 1980s, 47% of the people over the age of 20 were in the 20 to 40 high consuming group. And now only 37.8%, or about 10% less of the households, heads of households and things like that, are in that high consuming group. What we think happened was that once the economy turned around, this group, this big demographic group, said, well, it's time to go back and spend. I need things for my house, I need things for my yard, I need things for my kids and all those kinds of things. So spending picked up really quickly there. Now if you look, where are the big differences? Well, the big differences are in the 40 to 45, 45 to 50s, and 50 to 65. Those are groups with varying degrees of concern about retirement assets and rebuilding retirement assets. And so now we think what's going to happen is that people are going to be more reluctant to spend for a new widescreen TV or whatever, and more likely to try and rebuild their assets, their retirement base in there. And so because of that, we're expecting a much slower recovery will this happen? Who knows? But that's the hypothesis that we're working on.
Representative Hilty and yes. Representative Huntley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Stimson, with regard to the 45,000 jobs retained or created, what percentage of those should we assume would continue to exist once the stimulus money is exhausted?
Dr. Stimson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilton, construction jobs, by their very nature, are temporary. You don't, except for working on the Great Pyramids in Egypt, you don't have a lifetime job on a construction project or anything like that.
Well, if we would build one out of iron ore from Minnesota, we would appreciate that.
Just fill up some of those holes.
There you go. Reversed, yeah.
A lot of these jobs that are saved, are going to be permanent. I mean, I've got some notes here. Oh, here they are. In retail and wholesale, there are jobs that are being created or saved here. 7,000 created or saved. Without it, we would have lost 24,000 jobs in retail and wholesale. These are kind of spin-off jobs or secondary jobs from the economic activity that's going on. But once the economy starts to pick up again, then you would expect those jobs that were saved to be more secure. So a lot of, these aren't jobs that are necessarily going to disappear. Now, it may be that we will actually need additional spending through the stimulus package to make sure that the economy keeps on going at the rate that it should be normally growing at. But I'm optimistic that this is going to work, and these will be permanent jobs, that they won't die back after 2 years.
Representative Huntley?
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. In 81, 82, I was on the Duluth City Council, and Duluth had the Duluth Metropolitan Statistical Area had the second highest unemployment rate in America after Newark, New Jersey. It was 18%.
Yeah.
And it was probably 25% on the range. So it was really a severe problem for at least the northeastern part of the state.
So been there, done that. Don't want to do it again.
Don't want to do it again.
Dr. Simpson, do you want to continue on? Just one point of clarification. Commissioner Hansen, we've looked through the big books and we can't find that in there either. So the previous graph of the unemployment in Minnesota.
The graph that I just showed you?
Yeah.
No, we just made that.
Oh, okay. Very good. Well, then that's good. It's that one right there. That's the other one.
That one.
It's not in the large book, and that really does illustrate our problem as the reason I'm pointing it out.
Chairman, while we're on that, looked at the summary as well, and we referenced the U.S. unemployment here, but we don't reference Minnesota unemployment. And I think that, I don't know if you do a redraft of the summary, but probably it would be important to include not only the national but the Minnesota unemployment situation in the summary as well, because this is what a lot of people read. While I'm on that, Mr. Chairman, the other thing that's not really in the summary, at least, is any reference to your opening comments, Commissioner, about the $6.4 billion. You can arrive at that number by doing a little math, but it's not directly referenced there either. And that's, of course, another important number that probably should be included as well. We do sometimes read these, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Representative David.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To Dr. Stinson, Doctor, as we look at these forecasts through 2010, 2011, and 2012, what kind of tax policy are you factoring in there at the federal level, kind of where we're at now, or what the proposals are, for example, to go to a 60% tax rate on those making over $200,000 a year, raising the capital gains taxes? How would that influence your numbers? Are you going off the numbers, kind of way the tax policy is now, or have you factored some of those changes in?
Dr. Stinson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, this is a little more complicated. The National Economic Outlook has some tax change factored into it. Global Insight believes that as part of their baseline forecast that there will be, over the next 3 years, some tax increase compared to where we are right now. And they don't specifically draw out what kind of tax change it would be, but they do add to the collections of the federal government over that period in there. So I can't answer your question about whether it's high income individuals or capital gains or anything like that, but they do say that there will be some additional tax revenue collected beyond what would occur on current law. Now, for the specific piece of Minnesota capital gains collection that I talked about earlier, we factor that in directly into our model because the existing law, under existing law for the federal income tax, that would, in our estimation, create this one-time jump in realizations and then the slump following that. And we thought it was important that you'd be aware of that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Dr. Stinson.
Okay, continue on, Dr. Stinson. And maybe we can, that the graph that you have up there now, the age distribution, is kind of something that's pretty interesting, and maybe we can have the pages, if you wouldn't mind having some copies made. Would that be okay?
Sure.
Okay, they'll make some copies of that.
You want this one too?
Sure, would you please? Thank you, Dr. Simpson.
I just have two more things to tell you. One is an admonition that I gave you last November or December. As I said, things could be worse, and it turned out that they were worse, and we just didn't expect that they would be as much worse as they are. The pessimistic scenario that Global Insight has is not really that much more pessimistic than the baseline scenario. They have the recession extending until the start of 2001, but only very small declines in the economy in the second half of 2009. Again, this is not an unreasonable scenario. A lot of forecasters are moving closer to that scenario, and that would, of course, make a material difference in the revenues that we would expect in 2010-2011. The last slide that I have is what to watch for, what we're watching for. My staff and I, every day, we're monitoring the recent economic news, and I know that you all have much more to do than just pay attention to what's going on in the economic news on a daily basis. But there are a couple of items that if you pay attention to, you can see how well we're doing. And the big item that you need to pay attention to is consumer spending. What's happening to consumer spending? This is 70% of gross domestic product, and there's really no way that you can expect the economy to turn around if consumers are cutting back on their spending. And over the last two quarters, consumers have cut back on real inflation-adjusted spending by 3% at a 3% annual rate in each of those quarters. Global Insight has the forecast for consumer spending going down another 3% in the first quarter, but then it levels off and it starts to grow in midsummer. If we don't see that growth in consumer spending, that means that we're going to go into a more extended period of weakness.
Representative Kahn, to that point.
Yes. Just what does consumer spending consist of? Is it only durable goods? Or does it include restaurants, entertainment, things like that?
Dr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, there are three categories of consumer spending. There is consumer durable spending, which is furniture, big ticket items. There's consumer non-durable spending, which would be food and things like that, things with useful lives of less than 3 years. And then there's spending on services, healthcare, accounting services, haircuts, things like that. The combination of the three is declining and has declined. So again, back to this discussion of what is a recession, and this recession in particular, it's a broad-based decline, not in profit, but in actual economic activity in this case. And so that's what's going on here.
Representative Holbrook.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Stinson, a couple of years ago we started talking about deflation and housing values and the collapse of the housing market. Two questions. What do you see, or what have you read as far as people predicting how important will the turnaround in the house valuations be? Do they expect that will precede increased consumer spending? In other words, that people aren't going to start spending money until they see some recovery in their housing values. And then also on a similar vein, how important is the performance of the stock market to drive or dissuade consumer spending?
Dr. Spinson?
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Representative Colbert. Spending on housing values, housing prices, is not a precondition to the turnaround in consumer spending. And in fact, we would expect that would lag consumer spending increases by somewhere 6 to 9 months. Now, if the consumer spending uptick is delayed, that doesn't necessarily mean that the uptick in housing values, they're kind of separate markets at this point. With respect to the question of the importance of the stock market, one way that people replenish those retirement accounts is if their stock market account goes up a little bit, and so that would be good. Consumer spending most importantly depends upon income, after tax income actually. It also depends upon wealth, the value of your house and the value of your stock market accounts and your retirement accounts. It also depends upon consumer confidence, how good you feel about the economy, how much you think and how optimistic you are about the future. It depends upon the ratio of debt to net worth, how much you owe compared to how much you're worth. Right now, all of those factors are not in good shape. Consumer confidence is at the lowest it's ever been. Once we start turning around, then maybe some of these things will snowball a little bit. But clearly, the stock market's an important part of this because that wealth effect by itself is important. Households have lost somewhere on the order of $13 trillion in wealth since the end of 1987. Combination of stock market losses and housing wealth losses. The normal assumed estimate is about 5 cents on the dollar that it affects consumer spending. So you lose $100 in your stock market account or make $100 in your stock market account, you spend over the next year or so $5 of that more than you would have without it. So if you use that $13 trillion and 5 cents on the dollar, what that gives you is $650 billion less consumer spending than you would have had if the stock market and housing prices hadn't gone down substantially. So that's kind of that gives you an idea of the size of the problem that we're facing. And when you're faced with that kind of a number, you can see why almost $800 billion in stimulus package might not be enough, because there are other things going on besides that situation with respect to household wealth.
Hey, Dr. Spence, do you want to continue? I'm sorry, Representative Holbrook again.
If I might, I have one additional question. I don't know if this is for Mr. Schuyler or Commissioner Hansen. There seems to be some confusion around the issue of the Medicaid money and Health and Human Services, and in looking at the budget figures, it appears that there's over $10 billion of the budget in the Health and Human Services spending area. And so,
Mr. Holbrook, can I interrupt? Can we just have Dr. Stinson finish this slide, and then we'll go back to, sure. To Mr. Showalter. Dr. Stinson, you want to continue on, if you can hold your question.
Well, real quickly here, the other side of the consumer spending issue is savings rates. If you save the money, you don't spend it. If you spend it, you don't save it. And so you can also look at the savings rate. While it's good that the savings rate is increasing, it is an increase and a further increase in the savings rate means that we will probably have a little bit slower recovery. Credit markets have to improve. You've all heard of that. The issue that is normally the most important indicator, which is payroll employment. That I've put down on this list a little bit, partly because it's going to lag the recovery. The consumer spending is going to be the leader of the recovery. The other reason why I've put it down on the list is that it's hard to interpret this. And the example that some of you heard me give is that if on Friday the payroll employment numbers, U.S. payroll employment numbers are announced, then the announcement is that we have lost 400,000 jobs in the U.S. in the month of February. That's good news. And we're expecting we're going to lose more than that, substantially more than that. And so what you've got to pay attention to is not the sign of the number, but rather you've got to pay attention to the difference from month to month. If we start going down, that's good. And so that's what you want to be looking for. But the next couple of months are going to just be really ugly by all accounts. 600,000, 700,000 jobs lost. Then finally, we'll be producing an economic update on the 10th of April that will give you some idea of how the forecast is tracking with actual receipts for February and March. And just about the time you're finishing the session, we'll have information on final payments and refunds, which will give us some idea as to how the capital gains assumptions that we made for tax year 2008 are doing compared to what we actually are receiving.
Okay. Dr. Stinson, thank you a great deal. There may be some questions later on from people, but let's go to Representative Fulbright then.
And Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I didn't realize you wasn't done with that slide, and I thought I was moving on to the next one. It has to do with the strings attached, if you will, with the Medicaid money and the Health and Human Services portion of the state budget. And well, certainly some of the maintenance of effort spending we know needs to continue if we're to count all of the Medicaid federal stimulus money. How much is remaining in the Health and Human Services budget that would be available for reforms, or in other words, not tied up in strings from the federal government?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have a good breakdown because of what remains, simply because the strings that are attached are to eligibility. So that the federal government is saying to Minnesota or all the other states, whatever your eligibility was as of, I think it's 2008, you must maintain that eligibility structure. If you want to change your payment structure, if you want to change maybe some of your processes, maybe you can change those. Those have material impact on how much we're going to spend. So if you decide that you also want to change how much you want to pay for outpatient surgery, that's okay. You just can't disqualify somebody from eligibility in the medical assistance or our state Medicaid program. So a long way of getting at it is the medical assistance program is still there. You can still manage it. But one of the big levers that we have of managing it, that is eligibility, has been frozen.
And if I might, for follow-up, I'm assuming that you're doing some calculations on if, in fact, the enrollment of certain individuals is more expensive than the benefits. In other words, can you do any proportional cuts and lose a portion of the money, or is it all or nothing for the federal stimulus money?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative, let me give you an example of if there was a proposal to reduce, in say, hospital rates, as in the governor's budget, you could still make that proposal. But if it was initially worth $100 million, it would be worth something less than that in the repriced environment, simply because the federal government would be picking up a portion of that. We'd be losing some of that FSP. Let me try it again. Because that $100 million was the state share of a $200 million cost, Well, in the new environment, we wouldn't be paying $100 million of that $200 million cost. We'd be paying $80 million of that $200 million cost. So if you change the rate, you could only save that $80 million. And you'd let go of some of that federal participation that we showed in the earlier slide.
Okay, and then if I might, when are the strings cut? Are they cut within our biennial budget? Or, you know, what's the date in which we as a state no longer have to maintain the effort, if you will?
Mr. Chair, Representative, December 31st, 2010. Basically, when the federal enhanced participation stops, those strings stop as well.
And if I might, just for clarification then, so in the case of a biennial budget, then for three quarters of the budget, we'd have to maintain a certain effort, but that for a quarter of that budget, or i.e. 6 months, we could do reforms that would not negatively impact the federal stimulus money. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Holder.
Mr. Showalter, is that the reason why in fiscal year 10, you have from the federal stimulus $862 million and in 11, $497? Is it because of the six-month lag? Is that correct?
That, and Mr. Chair, that is exactly correct.
Okay,
you see that it's only really a half-year effect in 2011.
Thank you.
I have a question. The other day I asked you a question relative to the unallotment and higher education. And have you had a chance to clarify? You were going to do some checking with your staff, and if you're not prepared at the answer tonight, fine, we can get it later. Otherwise, if you could share it.
Mr. Chair, we had some conversations with Mr. Marks and Mr. Mossman this morning. I think we tentatively all believe that we probably would have to buy back. The question was regarding stabilization funding. That's the $800 million of the countercyclical funds that aren't included in the forecast but could be used to support education funding or general purposes. And the question is, how does that unallotment money play in? I'll try it. And then Mr. Marks and I can follow up to make sure that I did it correctly. But basically, there's a two-part test. 2006 is the minimum amount that we can spend. But then we have to maintain either the 2008 or the 2009 level. Since there's an unallotment in 2009, which is now the higher level that we have to buy our way back to, we believe the unallotment brings the 9 level down so that we have to bring it back up to the 8 level. So that we would basically have to use some of that stabilization funding to bring the 2009 unallotted figure up to the 2008 level.
Okay, that was the question I was asking, and so to simplify it, you'll have to buy that $40 million back that went to the university and MinSkill.
Mr. Chair, we will have to buy something back. I'm not sure if it's $40 million. But we can
to what that high point was.
That's right. We have to bring it back to the higher of the 2000.
If you can let us know what,
yeah,
when you fine tune that number, sure, then that would be fine. Are there any other questions of any of the three people at the table?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hildy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For Dr. Stinson, there's a lot of talk, of course, and various estimates about recovery. I'm wondering how you envision recovery. Do you think that, I mean, are you thinking that it's going to be possible for, at some point, people basically to go back doing what they were doing before this occurred, or what kinds of changes should we anticipate?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hogan, This is going to be different, and I thought about this more than a little bit because of the really devastating impact that the decline in housing values and the stock market had on retirement accounts. And it seems to me that probably a whole generation, I'm not quite sure what a whole generation is, but you know, people over a 10 or 15 year age span who are approaching retirement are going to have to reset what their expectations were for retirement. I was talking to one of my staff this morning, and he said that he went and talked to a financial advisor, and his Roth IRA is down 50%, and this is a guy who's at most 30 years old. Well, this is not going to change his life. I mean, you know, he's going to put in a lot of money at these lower rates and so on like that. But for somebody who's 60 years old and their Roth IRA is down by 50%, there's really no hope that it's going to come back to that level that they had before. There's just some really unpleasant arithmetic, and really unpleasant arithmetic is that if you have a loss of 50%, you have to have a gain of 100% in order to get back to where you were. And so there's going to be a resetting of expectations for a large proportion of people in there. With respect to the changes in the structure of the economy, there's always evolution in the economy, but I don't think that this is going to do away with one sector or one type of activity or anything like that. I think we're going to see areas where there's going to be more growth, and I think we're going to see areas that are going to have less growth, but I don't think that's going to change. But I am concerned about the impact on people that are approaching retirement.
Rep. Tim McNamara, and then we've got to get, let the commissioner, we've got two more charts to wrap up.
Dr. Simpson, if you were a Minnesotan that believed the wealthy potentially should or could pay more, would you think that the policy would be better to be done at the national level, or would it be better to be done at the state level if you were a person that believed that?
It's an easy question to answer, and the reason why it's an easy question to answer is because of migration, that we don't have constraints that you have to live in Minnesota and you can't go across the border or anything like that. So programs that provide unequal incentives to different income classes are going to promote migration, and there are going to be secondary effects from that. And so certainly for income distributional purposes, you know, you need to have stronger national action as opposed to stronger state action.
So
just a quick follow-up, Dr. Stinson. So I think, just to bring it down to landscaper's terms, that if you raise the taxes in Minnesota, there could be some negative impact because people could move to Florida or Arizona and establish residency by staying there for 6 months in a day, as opposed to if the federal government raised the taxes, it gets raised in all states and we're more realizing that Minnesota is not an island, if I understand what you're saying from an economic standpoint.
Now, you know, there is this whole tax and spending issue. There's another side to it, and that is that if what we do is take the money that was collected, the additional money that's collected, and make the state more desirable than someplace, Arizona or Texas or wherever that's a lower tax state, you know, people don't just make their decisions based on taxes alone. They make their decisions based on the combination of the cost of the services they receive and the services they receive or the quality of life in the place that they're at. And so, you know, it's not totally simple or anything like that. There are two sides to the issue, but with respect to the simple question of income redistributional activity, it's always better to do that at the national level rather than the state level because of migration.
Okay,
thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to, you know, when we talk about doing on the higher incomes, if you believe that federal versus state, Minnesota is a net contributor to the federal government in terms of dollars spent versus dollars spent and how much we pay into federal income. So I'm just, does that play into that answer, or how would that play into the answer you just gave?
Dr. Simpson.
I don't know if it does very much. that the federal, I've actually done some stuff on where does the money go and where does the money come from and why are we a net contributor. It's not very recent, but I'm sure that stuff hasn't changed much. And part of what's going on is that Minnesotans are paying a lot of Social Security tax and Medicare tax, and then they retire in some other place. And so Arizona or Florida or Texas are picking up that money. And then, so it's not money. Minnesotans are getting the money. It's just that the Minnesotans that have gone to Arizona or whatever.
Representative Benedict. Representative Solberg.
Dr. Stinson, as I sat on the Council of Economic Advisors, one of the advisors said that the federal government has more flexibility in dealing with the recession, so they can have mimeograph machines. The question I asked, want to ask you, is it better to raise a tax or is it better to cut an expenditure?
Mr. Chairman, there's a simple mathematical result that Representative Fund can drive for you in your spare time. That's called the balanced budget multiplier, and the implication of that is that it's better to raise taxes than to cut spending. I know it's counterintuitive, but the implication of that is, and it's because if you cut spending, you lose one round of spending that would have gone on, whereas taxes, part of that spending from taxes, part of the tax cut is absorbed by saving less. And so you don't drop your consumption by the total amount that you have been taxed. Some of that goes away from tax, from saving.
Mr. Chairman, I ask that because there's never a simple answer or a simple solution to any of our concerns that we have. And economists, we know when they line them up in a straight line, they all point in a different direction.
Representative Kissmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, Dr. Simpson, I'm a little bit puzzled by that because to take money out of the taxpayer's wallet, they don't have it to do this consumer spending. How does that square with more consumer spending would help us?
What?
Dr. Stinson.
Maybe I misunderstood what you were...
Representative Kissmeyer.
Would not be difficult. I'm not a PhD.
Yeah, Representative Kissmeyer. You're right that if you take money out of the consumer's wallet and have it for taxes, they can't spend it for household goods. However, if there's no money put in the wallet in the first place because they lose their job, they're not spending it for consumer goods either.
Why don't we wrap up with the last two charts? Mr. Hans.
Mr. Chairman, members, just two more quick charts.
I'm assuming that you were the one that was going to do the last two. Yeah.
Yes, I'm here for a reason. So I did hear that call. The federal stimulus, Mr. Chairman, as we've discussed, is one-time money. This chart is just designed to show you that the structural problem we have in our budget continues into 12 and 13, and that the tails number is 5.1, and then you see the inflation number at the bottom of the slide, considerably less than about the $1.1 billion we were estimating for inflation in May of 2007. It's now only $170 million, and the 12 and 13 number at 1.36. Then if you look at the last slide, you see again the overall numbers, $236 million in 8 and 9, and 4.5, 7, and 10, and 11. And then, Mr. Chairman, the other point I wanted to make, and I know we don't usually, when we do the forecast presentation, talk about the governor's budget, but now that you know that the number is 4.5, I want you to turn it over for a minute, because the impact on the governor's budget with this forecast is different than normal. And that's because we booked in the governor's budget in January the $920 million of stimulus money that is now counted in the forecast. So essentially that $920 million goes away. You know, it's not available for us to solve the 4.5. So 4.8 minus 920 minus whatever MOE requirements and human services we have to abide by, roughly the governor's solution today is worth about $3.7 billion. So we'll be solving up to the 4.6. I'm available for questions on that. I know it's a counterintuitive concept, but it was, we can't spend the federal stimulus twice. In this case, we're spending it in the forecast, and it's not available to the governor, so the 920 plus the 200.
And I think, Commissioner, we understood that that 920 was a holding number.
Yeah.
Because at the point you plugged that in, we had
right.
a conversation about it. It was understood that that was the best guess at the time. I do have a question of you on the last chart, the budget balance of 236. And you heard my question, Mr. Showalter, about the unallotment and the $40 million or whatever that final number is. Would that not impact the bottom line there in terms of what the budget balance is then? Or maybe another way of putting it would be, when is that $40 million and be stored?
Mr. Chair, if I may, I think that would affect the value of that stabilization money for part of a budget solution. So that you wouldn't
I understand
be able
to it would impact on the value of the stabilization money, but if you restore the $40 million, would that not, then you're taking some of that stabilization money to restore it, and if you do that in this fiscal year, then would your 236 not drop to roughly 200?
Mr. Chairman, if like anything else, we now have our baseline of forecast, and anything we, based on current law, if we make those adjustments, then yeah, probably would, but it would be an ongoing adjustment in 2009, just like any other appropriation we might pass, is how I see it. So if we make an interpretation or we pass something in a week or two, and then it's, you know, 40 million, 236 minus 40 million. But the forecast won't change. That makes sense?
I think so.
All right. Well.
Mr. Marks, I won't call on him, but he was thinking something with this whole conversation. I'm not sure what it was, but we can check later. I think I saw a hand with the Representative Cole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, or Mr. Showalter, can you... I'm sorry, this should be simpler, but I'm struggling with this. The $30.7 billion in revenue projected for 10 and 11, how much, if any, of that is the federal stimulus money? And look at the two charts here, the last two slides, it's a little confusing to me how much, if any, of it is federal stimulus money.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cole, the none of the revenue is federal stimulus money. It is reflected in a reduced spending number. $35.5 billion would be higher if the federal stimulus wasn't there.
So, Mr. Chair, Commissioner, put another way, then the $30.7 billion is the revenues projected under current laws, the income taxes, fees, sales taxes. That's there's no stimulus money there. That's what's coming in under
that's
current law,
yes.
Regardless of what the federal government has done. No,
that's what we're collecting. Projected.
We were dealing with that $40 million yet here with the notes. Representative Coles?
No, I'm not thinking
about okay. Representative Kiffmeyer?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I just was noodling some more here about the comment that Dr. Stinson made in regards to reducing taxes and increasing, encouraging spending and so on, and but then having a job. Would the logic then follow that you might want to tax 100% and then everybody would have jobs?
Stinson, is that for Dr. Stinson?
Yes, sir.
I think this has probably gone far enough.
good answer.
Any other questions or comments before we adjourn? Then I have one announcement for the members of the Finance Committee. Next Monday, we're going to have two bills up before Finance full year start time, and also the funding for the Heritage Advisory Board. You know, that money doesn't begin to flow yet, and they do need some money to get them until July 1st or thereabouts. And so there's a bill that's been approved by the division to get them some money to continue to operate. And it'll be 10:30 on Monday.
And the Means Committee is adjourned?
And before the Finance Committee adjourns, we do have the freshman members event tonight that we've all been invited to. So that's probably still going on, and with that being adjourned.
Wait, the Means Committee didn't get that enough.